you know, the singular advantage that the authors of these regimes have had to this point is mystery and mystique and secrecy. Yeah. That nobody knows what's going on behind these closed doors. That they can basically write an agreement that in some ways represents almost a coup d'etat of all of the governments in this world that belong to this regime, without anybody kind of realizing that that's what's happened, is an enormous advantage for them. You know? And so they've gone to great lengths to keep anybody from learning about what's being discussed until, at the end of the day, an agreement this thick is presented to governments with the following proposition. Take it or leave it. Don't imagine that you can amend it. This is fast track in the United States, as you recognize, but in other places it's informal. Because this was the product of a very intricate set of compromises, they will unravel if you think you can make changes. You can either jump on this global bandwagon or become the next Albania. So very, very powerful regime. We can refuse to be hornswoggled by this, and that's what this meeting is about. We can insist on becoming literate in these matters. We can say, you know, screw you to people who would rather us be mystified or bamboozled into believing that these relationships are too complicated for us to understand. And we have been doing that. And the defeat of the MAI is truly a remarkable accomplishment. And in large measure accomplished by groups like this, like folks working at a very kind of grassroots level, organizing at the grassroots level, mobilizing their own local governments, and communicating with each other over the internet. The fast-track defeats in the United States are also enormously encouraging in terms of our capacity to push back against this agenda. And the other thing that's happened, which sets the stage for, I think, a major reversal of this globalization onslaught, is the fact that since the WTO was created in 1995, the literacy of a lot of developing countries has increased exponentially. You know, these were entirely new and unprecedented, in many ways revolutionary and radical agreements that got subsumed in the WTO. Now people are beginning to understand their enormous and pervasive kind of destructive impact. This is less obvious in the United States, where your economy is in fabulous shape. But it's very and very painfully apparent to a lot of people, a lot of places on this planet, and who are ready to question in a way they haven't been able to in the past, this kind of juggernaut. So the fact that the meeting is here this fall means you will get to participate, and I think what will really be a watershed, if the WTO was a watershed in 1995 for the forces of globalization, this will be one for us. We need to transform. If you wonder what the alternative is, there are lots of ways to express it. But really, the international trade agreement, I say we need from is an agreement about climate change, is an agreement about biodiversity, is an agreement about food security. These are the goals of international trade, not growth and corporate profits. And when you begin to think about international trade agreements in those terms, you begin to understand that how powerful these devices of enforcement become when they're enlisted to achieve the goals that we're working for. Anyway, thanks. I went on a bit too long, but there's still time for questions. Well, the way it works is it's kind of a self-enforcement regime. If the value of the trade that you have lost as a result of this regulation is $150 million, you're entitled to impose trade sanctions against the U.S. to that extent. So Brazil and Venezuela have the option of finding some way to impose that penalty on the U.S. And they can, it's called a regime of cross retaliation. So they don't have to impose some kind of tariff, some import tariff on fuel from the United States, because they don't import fuel from the United States. They can impose a tariff on computer software, or they can refuse to recognize the intellectual property of the people making videos. Right. Now, if you're a weak country and a relatively poor country, your options are limited. And so the other moderating influence here is power, always has been. The United States holds a lot of cards in its deck. When you've got countries of the size of Venezuela and Brazil, they do have options available to them. But it's a self-enforcement regime. The WTO says to you, if the U.S. doesn't respond by amending its domestic law, you can impose retaliatory sanctions against it to the order of $150 million a year. I have one, two, three. ISO 14000 is, the ISO 14000 is kind of an international regime for establishing standards regulation that doesn't have a lot of credibility with people in the environmental community because it actually doesn't establish any performance measures. But it's an effort to try to transform what should be substantive health and safety or workplace or environmental standards into something that's really process-oriented. And if it succeeds, they'd love to get this kind of enshrined in the WTO because it wouldn't actually hold any particular corporation to anything other than attesting to the fact that it had used a certain process in order to audit its environmental performance. And that's my understanding of the ISO. It's another international effort to constrain, in a sense, the development of performance-related domestic environmental standards. And that's my perspective. Yeah?
If we're saying that WTO is good enough for everybody else, but not the United States, is that threat to disrupt
the last cards? It does, actually. It's hard to know how disruptive it would be. There's a dispute between the United States and Europe having to do with access to European markets for Chiquita banana. And the Europeans have a special trade arrangement with some of the Caribbean islands, as I understand it. And, it might be part of their development package for those poor countries. But the U.S. has challenged, and they won. You always win. Every single environmental standard or conservation standard that's been challenged at the WTO has been defeated. There are no victories for our side. None. Zero. In any event, there's a big struggle now that's taking place between the United States and Europe as to whether or not Europe's actually going to knuckle under. The big question about this enforcement regime I described was that when push comes to shove, if it actually means the U.S. or Europe backing off on something they care about, will they actually respect the authority of this institution or not, of this enforcement regime or not? You know, a lot of developing countries are brought into this. They were saying, well, look, the WTO now is going to regulate a lot more of your domestic economic policy. But the trade-off is that it's going to be enforceable. So now the big wealthy countries in the north can't beat you up. You actually have meaningful enforcement opportunities under this regime. And the developing countries said, well, we don't think that the big boys are going to live by these rules when they really comes down to the brass knuckle fighting. And what we're seeing now in this fight between Europe and the United States, which are the big trading blocks, is whether or not this enforcement regime will be actually recognized by either of them when it really matters to them. And the WTO might not come apart. It may simply end up kind of being where people from the South cynically expected it always to end up, which is that, you know, these rules will be imposed on us, but it won't be a reciprocal regime. We won't be able to enforce effectively against northern countries. We don't have the economic leverage, and even when we do, they'll just thumb their nose at us. And the banana dispute, even though you think bananas, it's not that big a deal, what's waiting in the wings is the dispute about growth hormones, which the U.S. also won. So it went after European growth hormones, and it won the ban on growth hormones. And that is a matter of huge public policy importance in Europe. If you think about mad cow, if you think about food quality in Europe, there's no way the European community is going to kowtow to the WTO for the benefit of simply allowing U.S. and Canadian beef producers to sell hormone-fed beef into Europe. And so that struggle. They've kind of put off on the side. You know, Europe's done some things and the U.S. says, well, they're not enough and we're going to impose sanctions. And they're fighting it out. The proxy is this the banana dispute. But it's very important. You're right. Yeah. Well, it doesn't really yet, and you know, there's a lot of discussion about negotiating into the WTO something like the side agreements that you have in NAFTA. Yeah, I agree. I agree with that. It you know, this is a regime created to punish, in a sense, labor or those that would protect labor rights or to insist on a reasonable measure of compensation for workers, or to require corporations to pay taxes to support infrastructure for workers and their children. That's its very purpose. Its very purpose is to discourage public policy initiatives. So the notion that somehow you could fix this up at the margins with some kind of side agreement is a wonderful one if you have to give ground in the corporate community, because it's bogus. It isn't going to make a difference. But it just might persuade people that you're actually listening to their complaints. And I think it's very dangerous. And I think there's a, you know, there's, I think there's, a, again, there's a lack of understanding of how profoundly unsustainable this regime is that would lead anybody to conclude that somehow a side agreement on labor or environment or anything else, a social clause, could somehow work. I mean, I've argued that you can transform the WTO into an agreement for just, sustainable, and ecologically viable trade by simply putting "not" at the end of every single sentence, you know? And you more or less have it right. Yeah. Yeah, that's true. I mean, I think the reason the fast track was defeated, you know, I'm a Canadian, but I think the reason the fast track was defeated in the United States was there was a lot of support from the right who were, I mean, you know, I even resist the language of trade protectionism. They've co-opted the language. I mean, environmental protection, the notion of protection, whether you're protecting your children or the environment, was a good word. It was a nice word. Now it's a dirty word. It's a bad word. You know, economic self-reliance, food security, food self-reliance. I mean, those are good things. But now they're trade protectionism. I mean, they really have captured the language. But there are a lot of people, I think, in the right who do subscribe to those values of self-reliance and protection. And, you know, workers have fought for decades to get a decent wage and to get health plans. And we're not going to give it, we're not going to sacrifice it on the altar. Well, I mean, I think there are people that are uncomfortable. I mean, there's that story, you know, that I guess everybody's heard it now, the Ralph Nader $1,000 offer. You know, not everyone's heard it. Ralph Nader posted $1,000 to any member of Congress who was supportive of NAFTA who would agree to read it and answer some questions about it. And so a Republican, it was around for about a year, and finally a Republican congressman, who was a very avid pro-free trader, said, okay, I'll take you up on the offer and going back to my constituents this summer. Read it. It kind of has a fairy tale ending. I mean, when he read it, he, turned 180 degrees and became a vigorous opponent and actually organized among some Republican colleagues of his who were, to that point, supporting the regime. So there's nothing like a little literacy. We have an example of that in Canada. I was having a discussion about this earlier, but the guy named John Turner, who led our Liberal Party in, and this is a party of the corporations, actually read the trade deal. And, I mean, you really choke when you actually read this. And I encourage people to read it. I mean, it's not the thick documents, a lot of schedules, and, you know, get this guide. It's, you know, the basic nuts and bolts of this aren't that hard to figure out. And, you know, just resist the whole notion that you're not smart enough to understand it. If I am, you are. You know, let me just add one thing to my comments, because, you know, there are all these other negotiations going on, these trade negotiations, and the reason for them is, I think, twofold. There were two things missing from the WTO. They didn't get investment rules. They have a chapter on investment called trade-related investment measures, but it's bare bones. They didn't get an MAI, and they wanted it. The MAI is now in Chapter 11 of NAFTA, as you know. It was the prototype for the MAI, which expanded Chapter 11 only a little. They wanted it in the WTO. That was always the plan. On that single point alone, developing countries said, no way. We've had to swallow a lot, but we're not taking these investment rules. This is in 94. And so the investment chapter of the WTO wasn't what they needed. So they decided, well, we'll pursue this in other ways. And they went to both APEC and the OECD, and they said, we'll do this deal among countries that understand the value of these rules. And then when we have an international agreement, we'll pick off some countries from the south one by one. You know, maybe the dollar's collapsing in Indonesia or Brazil, and we'll make them an offer they can't refuse. And once we've broken the united opposition of this group of 77, which is this kind of block of developing countries, then we'll get it into the WTO. That was the plan. And the reason, what's different about the MAI, what's so different about it, if the WTO is revolutionary in terms of the GATT, the MAI is like, if the WTO was a coup d'etat, then the MAI would be a coup de grâce. You know that phrase? This is like a phrase from medieval battles. You know, you have people wounded on the battlefield, and there'd be these people who go out and kill them. It would be like the stroke of grace. It would be like, put them out of their misery. You know, I mean, there's no way they're going to really survive. So it's kind of like, for governments who still think there might be life after the WTO, along comes the MAI. And what's so radical about it, what's so truly revolutionary, is that it provides a direct right of enforcement for every foreign investor to invoke incredibly powerful, very, very secretive international arbitration dispute processes to bring governments to heel. It elevates every single foreign investor, these are corporations, to the status of a nation state in terms of enforcing rights under a treaty under which they owe no obligation whatsoever, and to which, of course, they are not a party. There is no precedent for it at all in international law other than the Universal Declaration on Human Rights. And to somehow equate the kind of remedies that are available to people who've been denied their basic human rights in a relatively non-enforceable context at the United Nations to this incredibly powerful regime that the MAI would create is a huge hop, skip, and a jump. It's truly stunning, and the ambition is to still get it in the WTO. It was always the ambition, and it's not diminished at all, though it's smarting from its defeat. The other thing they didn't get in the WTO, other than direct right of enforcement, was an agreement on tariffs across the board, just to get rid of all tariffs. Unlike NAFTA, where Mexico, Canada, and the United States have given up their tariff power, under the WTO, you can still use tariffs at the border. You can still say, well, we're going to impose an export tax on that unprocessed fish or a raw log, or we're going to impose an import tariff on this product because we have domestic producers we want to protect. They didn't manage to get agreement among all countries on a cross-sectoral basis to simply get rid of this one tool that's left. And so that's why you've got all these free trade negotiations taking place at APEC and, you know, in between Europe and the United States. Those negotiations are about tariffs. Those are the two missing pieces from the whole big enchilada they like to create. Okay, I just had a question come back here just asking me to say something about labor rights. And I'm not an expert on labor rights, but the whole purpose of this regime is to prevent governments from regulating trade for the purposes of insisting on raising the level of worker benefits, whether that is the right to join a union or to receive a decent wage. The principal way in which That playing field would be elevated rather than reduced to the lowest common denominator would be to allow governments the authority to say, we will not trade. We will not trade in goods that come from a country that employs child labor, prison labor, that pays its workers unconscionable wages, that allows corporations to operate with complete indifference to workplace health and safety matters, that allows them off scot-free in terms of paying taxes to support infrastructure. We are going to use our authority as a nation, the United States, it would be the authority to regulate access to our markets in order to elevate the circumstances of workers around the world. Rather than engage in a beggar-thy-neighbor race to the bottom of worker protection and labor standards, all for the purposes of increasing the profits of the world's largest corporations. I don't know what else to say about labor rights. I mean, it couldn't be a more direct assault on the notion of trying to protect workers or improve their circumstances in the world. And this notion somehow that we have to now compete with people who are so desperate that they're willing to work for several dollars a day is enormously exploitive, not only of them, but of workers here as well. I don't know if that's terribly helpful. I think that's pretty obvious to folks, but I hadn't really said very much about it. And that's my 2 cents worth. Yeah, two more questions, I guess, there and there. Oh, it's a question about Clinton and why he's been so supportive of this agenda, which I really, I mean, I can't answer, you know. I mean, it, well, I mean, when he meets with environmentalists, he says, look, all of this is unfortunate and I don't like it, but there's not much I can do about it. It's inevitable. I mean, you know, I've heard other political leaders say that, but they haven't been in quite the position of influence that Clinton is. But so substantial is the influence of global capital that protests from presidents don't mean a lot. I mean, some of you will recall Eisenhower's speech. When was that? Of 56, 57, when he railed against the military-industrial complex and its power and influence in American life. And I remember an absolutely stunning speech by Jimmy Carter about the oil and gas industry. When was that? 75? Yeah, which is stunning. I mean, it was, I haven't said anything as radical today as he offered in that speech. So you do have examples of you know, the leader of the most powerful nation in the world actually being pretty damn blunt in terms of corporate rule. And it not making much of a difference other than that they don't get reelected. It's great. Can I just, there's another, can I take one more question? Can I just tell you one little anecdote in response to this, though? It's maybe, I had a meeting in Europe in 90 or 91 with a bunch of people working on agriculture and the environment in Amsterdam. And of all people, the EC ambassador to GATT showed up at this meeting because he's a friend of Mark Ritchie's, actually. And his name was Tran Van Tan. So he was the EC ambassador to GATT. He's probably the most powerful diplomat in the world. The European community is the world's largest trading bloc, and these trade negotiations are really the biggest show in town. And I was in a little group meeting with him, only with 20 people. And we're talking about the environment in GATT. And he said, if you think that you can amend the GATT to become the WTO to include environmental language, you're dreaming in technicolor. Not going to happen. All you could do is set the stage for discussions about environmental issues after the WTO is created. That happened, actually. So I said to him, well, if we can't do anything about the substance of the GATT, how about something about processes of negotiation and dispute resolution, because they're so secretive? And he kind of looked at me quizzically, and I said, well, you know, because they're undemocratic. And he laughed. And I said, well, why are you laughing? So he said, because they're not undemocratic. So I said, not undemocratic? He said, no, no. They're anti-democratic. So this I have, and he explained why. He was, so this is a very unusual. Now, he's since retired, so I can tell his story. But it's a true story. And it came from probably the most authoritative source you might have on the subject. And that was the way he described the regime. Not indifferent to democracy, determined and opposed to it. Okay, thank you. Okay. Sal, thank you, everybody, for that.
We invite you to join with other concerned members of civil society in their demonstrations against the World Trade Organization in Seattle from November 29th to December 3rd. People from all across America and around the world are coming to Seattle to oppose the anti-democratic WTO during its secret closed-door trade negotiations. For more information on the demonstrations, talks, and workshops held by civil society during the WTO negotiations, please call 1-877-STOP-WTO or visit the websites www.peopleforfairtrade.org and www.seattlewto.org.